We're a little early, but we wanted to make sure if you had clients who are going to be observing that they would have the chance to be in the room, the Zoom room, so they could see. So, Madam Clerk, Marshall, will you please call the case?
Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Riley, Judge Warkey, and Judge Bratfold, the Honorable Denise Riley presiding. Now calling the case of Stone versus Mosier, A20-0571.
Thank you. And I know that both of you are experienced attorneys, so you know that you each have 15 minutes with 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. And state your name at the beginning of your argument because this is being recorded. So with that, we'll turn to appellant's attorney.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is R.J. Dietrich, Dietrich, D-E-T-R-I-C-K. I'm an assistant attorney general representing the appellants in this matter. Now, Your Honors, qualified immunity protects state officials from liability unless their conduct violates clearly established constitutional law. And in assessing whether qualified immunity applies, the court looks at whether there is a constitutional violation and whether that if there is a constitutional violation, whether that violation is a violation of clearly established law, meaning there is law that would have put the defendants on notice that their conduct was unlawful. Now, in this case, a respondent is committed to the Minnesota Sex Offender Program, and he sues appellants who are employees of the Minnesota Sex Offender Program, claiming that they failed to protect him from an assault by another person committed to the Minnesota Sex Offender Program, MB. And now the district court denied summary judgment and qualified immunity at the summary judgment stage, despite the fact that the record evidence shows that the the respondent put himself in the position that he claims that the appellants should have protected him from. Now, the undisputed facts show that the respondent only had contact with this other individual, MB, because he worked on the Omega-3 unit, which was the unit where MB lived. Vocational placements like this at MSOP are entirely voluntary. It was a respondent's choice to work on that unit. And after there were threats against respondent by MB in late July of 2016, MSOP vocational staff spoke with respondent to make sure he was comfortable continuing to work on that unit. And made clear that he didn't have to if he didn't want to. Respondent initially decided that he didn't want to continue working on that unit, so they told him to stop attending his shifts, don't work there anymore. The next day, he changed his mind, said he wanted to go back to working on the unit, and that's the only reason why he continued to work on the unit, because he wanted to. No one forced him to work on that unit, which again was the only place he had contact with MB.
Counsel, I'd like to probe a little bit so that I make sure I understand the where this argument fits in the construct about qualified immunity. You already described it's a two-step analysis, but yes, then you sort of segued over to the plaintiff's voluntary decision to work as a cleaner. So that I assume is a response to the first step of the analysis, or are you fitting that more under the failure to protect claim?
Your Honor, the fact that the respondent chose to work on that unit and ultimately voluntarily put himself in the position that he claims that appellant should have protected him from shows both that there was no constitutional violation and also on the second step of the qualified immunity analysis that there was no a violation of clearly established law. So if it's
wait a second, though. I mean, your argument's very fact specific, right? It's not about what the law provides. You do cite a bunch of cases that talk about a plaintiff in confinement putting themselves voluntarily in a dangerous situation, but those aren't qualified immunity cases, I believe. I mean, that's my reading of the cases. So, if I'm just trying to fit your argument to the construct that you told me to apply, the two steps, and I'm struggling. It, like I said, it sounds very fact specific, almost as though you're arguing a causation type analysis, which is normally something that would be, we would consider later, right? It's not part of this analysis.
Well, Your Honor, those cases that you mentioned that I cited state that in order for there to be a failure to protect violation, the reason that there is the requirement this failure to protect rule is that a person who's detained loses, some of the ability to exercise responsibility for their own welfare, loses some of the ability to protect themselves. But these cases establish that when the person still has the ability to exercise the ability to protect themselves and doesn't do that and puts themselves in a situation where that results in their injury, then there is no failure to protect violation. So here, Mr. Stone, as I said, chose to work on that unit, chose to be in contact with with MB, and was also told, after these threats that I mentioned, that if he ever felt unsafe on the unit, he should walk off the unit and leave. Now, he claims that he only continued to work on the unit after that because he believed that there was some sort of practice in place that required staff to follow him around the unit while he cleaned and to lock MB in his room while appellant was on the unit. But on the day of this particular incident, September 7th, 2016, it's clear that respondent knew that this particular practice was not being followed. And yet he chose to walk up to MB anyway, even though he knew he walked right up to MB. And I would encourage the court to look at the video in this case, if the court is not already. The video shows appellants on the second floor of this Omega-3 unit where MB lived and respondent worked. And it shows appellants Preston and Wallace assisting MB getting some stuff out of the janitor's closet, respondent. And then respondent walks in the opposite direction down the corridor straight towards MB's room, looks behind him as appellants Preston and Wallace are walking with their backs turned to him in the opposite direction down the stairs and walk straight up to MB, who's clearly visible on the video the entire time that he's walking down the corridor.
So I did look at the videos and I don't think they're as clear as you think they are. I think that different people could have different interpretations of them. And so if we think that those videos can only be interpreted in the way that you say they can be interpreted, what does that do to your argument? If we don't find the videos conclusive, then what?
Well, Your Honor, there's not just the videos, there's also other evidence, there's respondents own statements. He said the day after this incident occurred, he told the security counselor that as he was walking down this corridor, he saw MB in the room as he was walking right up to him. He also said in an affidavit of restitution that he is in the record and that respondent submitted in MB's criminal case, that he asked MB to be brought up to his room. And then when he was asked about this during his deposition, he said that he assumed as he was walking towards that room that MB was in the room. So, Your Honor,
but even did if- he also assume that he was being his back was being watched by your clients?
Yes, Your Honor, that is also what he said. As I said, I think the video clearly, so that no reasonable jury could believe it, contradicts that. It clearly shows that him turn around and look back as the appellants are walking down the stairs and heading in the other direction.
Well, it may show that, but we don't know what he saw. It happens pretty quickly.
Right. I would disagree. I think it does clearly show that. But even if not, he still chose to walk right up to MB, this individual that he claimed to fear so much. He'd been told repeatedly that if he felt unsafe around MB, he should walk off the unit and leave. He chose not to do that. He voluntarily put himself in that situation. And so the appellants are not liable for any constitutional violation. I want to move on to the...
Dietrich, before you do that, it sounds like at trial that there was a closer determination as to whether Mosier could be taken out of the group of individuals that have been charged in this matter. And collectively, Stone treats them all the same. Can you just reiterate that your position as far as pulling one or two out and how we can do that, or should we have them all collectively decided as the district court did?
Certainly, Your Honor. So appellant Mosier is the facility director at MSOP. He wasn't there on September 7th, 2016 when the respondent was actually assaulted. And at the summary judgment motion hearing, respondent actually conceded that he could not make out any claim against Mr. Mosier. So I think at the very least here, there's no constitutional claim that can be asserted against Mr. Mosier. And I think that the respondent has already conceded that. His theory of the case was that there was this protocol that I mentioned in place, and that on this particular day, that protocol was not followed. But there's no evidence that Mosier had any part in that happening. So certainly at the very least, Mosier should be granted qualified immunity and taken out of this case.
That question, of course, will go to Mr. Swanson, who perhaps can make our job easier or perhaps won't. Thank you.
Thank you. Moving on to the very quickly qualified immunity, the court, Supreme Court stated in Stacey versus Polly that in order for a state official to have been on notice that their conduct violated the Constitution, there needs to be more than just a principle of law defined at a high level of generality. And the court indicated in that case that Court of Appeals actually errs, and a district court errs if it does not identify a case on similar facts where a defendant was found liable if it denies qualified immunity without doing that. Here, the Court of Appeals, district court did not identify such a case, and respondent has not identified such a case. He's identified this Nelson versus Shuffman case. But in that case, the plaintiff was placed in a room and assaulted the same night. He had no control over whether or not he lived in that room. Respondent voluntarily put himself in that situation. So it's a completely different situation. Nelson would not have put the appellants on notice here that they were required to act differently. Very quickly, because I see my time is running out, even if the court doesn't look at the video and just looks at the district court's order, appellants are still entitled to qualified immunity because the district court's order indicates that the last threat connected to any specific date that any of the appellants were aware of occurred way back in late July of 2016. This assault didn't occur until September 7th, 2016, almost 6 weeks later. And the Eighth Circuit stated in Prater versus Dam that as little as a two-week period between a threat and an assault is enough time for officials to conclude that there's no longer a substantial risk of serious harm, which is required for a failure to protect constitutional violation. So here, where there was this much longer period, again, there's no authority that would have put the appellant on notice that they were required to take such drastic steps to protect respondent from MB, given the timing of the threat, especially considering, as I've already stated, that the video shows that respondent apparently didn't even seem to believe that there was such a threat because he was willing to walk right up to the individual. So, Your Honors, with that, I see that my time is just about up. And so I ask that the court reverse the district court's order and grant the appellant's qualified immunity. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for respondent.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you very much. My name is Scott Swanson, S-W-A-N-S-O-N. I represent Mr. Stone along with some other attorneys.
So of course, I'm gonna ask you, Mr. Moser, what do you want us to do with him? Or are you arguing that he's collectively yet in?
I thought the district court was going to just dismiss him. We couldn't flat out concede it and just say, knock him out because we hadn't talked to our client, but we, in a sense, dropped him from any argument because we recognize that that's not our case. So I think.
So that's my question. Are you dropping him now from your argument?
I'm not including him in my argument, Your Honor. That's for sure. So I think we can ignore him, to put it, if that helps you, or if that answers the question. I'm not addressing him. I don't think he's a part of this case. This case is Preston and Wallace, the two security guards and their failure to protect. Moving backwards just from what counsel said regarding the district court's order and the Prater Dom case and saying that 2 weeks was enough. You know, if you look at that case, it was enough because the animosity between the two participants in that case had pretty much been over. There weren't any other problems. In our case, however, so let's use the July meeting at the MSOP where MB made threats and the therapist made notes of that and was concerned and put it out on the computer system. It's called the Phoenix system. Even if that's the last threat, Mr. Stone's testimony, I believe, is that he continued to receive threats from Mr. Bantu nearly every time he was on the unit when MB was in his cell locked behind the door. So these things continued, and he says it was continuous, and so that makes this different than the Prater v. Dom case. There's a reason why it took a month and a half or so before MB was able to attack, because they had the protocol, which actually started when you had the exposure incident back in June. If you look at the incident reports, the Guards Institute of Practice, where they had Mr. Stone accompanied up on that unit and on that tier for his cleaning duties, always by two guards. And he said that continued on. The reason why MB couldn't get at him in the intervening time was because he was protected. He was accompanied. The protocol was followed. He just waited and waited. And as soon as it wasn't followed, he took his chance. And that's what happened here. And so it's not anything that Mr. Stone did. Going back to counsel's initial argument and your initial question about where does this fit in with the analysis of him voluntarily staying on the job and walking into it. And I think that it does go to the first question, is there a constitutional violation? Because, but the cases counsel cites, like where someone takes the risk, it's more of a general risk. It's like, well, I continued on the job in the wood shop where I was working on the table saw and, I chopped my hand off. I wasn't careful with using that. It's the nature of the job that caused the harm. Here, that he was a cleaner, that his job was cleaning, isn't the proximate cause of what caused the injury. That just created the happenstance for why he was in the unit. Why he was injured was because they failed to protect him despite the known risk. And so if we look at that, and I'll address that more carefully in a moment, but I do want to address one more thing counsel said. It was near the end of his argument where he said, you know, he's right. Qualified immunity, you have to have more than just a real high level statement saying, for instance, just saying, well, prisoners or people like Mr. Stone in a sex offender facility who's civilly committed, you have to protect them. That's a real broad 50,000 foot level statement. You got to get down closer to it. But I submit Nelson v. Shuffman or Shuffman v. Nelson does just that. And we analyze that in our brief. I'm not going to bore you with the details, but I think it's both on the facts and the law, it's very applicable. And they're distinguishing things saying, well, the guy, they placed him in a cell versus, you know, here they didn't necessarily force and push Mr. Stone down the way, but they did some things that caused him to go down the way, unaware that he was going to be attacked.
So counsel, that's the piece I'd like you to address, if you would, on the Nelson case, proving your analogy there, is what is it that Preston and Wallace did to make Mr. Sure.
Well,
walk down the hallway? I mean, I would like you to get as specific as possible, right, because it does seem to me that, you know, the roommate assignment in Nelson is different in some respects.
But in this case, they didn't like shove him down the hall, but what they did is he walked down the hall because of assurances they made that he wasn't there. If you recall, I believe Mr. Stone testified that he gets there. The normal procedure was they would go down, look, if Mr. MB was in his room, they would lock the door, secure him, and then they'd accompany him, he'd clean, he'd leave, and then MB could get out. Here, they went down and they checked, he said, and then they left the door open. Stone asked them, is he there? Where is he? Well, he's not there. He's visiting, and they have a different visiting place in the facility. So he's understanding the guy's not there. So of course he can walk down the hall, and you watch the video, he's strolling down. Why would a guy, if he could clearly see Mr. Bantu there, and you can't see it in the video that it's him, if they've already told him he's not there, and if he did see someone there, he says he didn't until maybe the last minute. You know, his statement that they refer to doesn't say exactly when it was he saw him. I mean, he could have been referring to the last minute where the guy steps out and he sees that a punch is coming and he gets knocked down. But my point just is, they tell him he's not there. He thinks he's not there. This is a guy who can finally walk down there today, that day, and maybe be a little bit relaxed, because the guy's not in there. He's not going to be screaming and threatening him, not threatening to kill him, making threats, snitches get stitches, and that kind of thing. And so they told him. But the thing is, Bantu was there. So they knew he was there. And if you look at the Prater v. Dam case is really good, because the Seventh Circuit gives you an analogy. Seventh Circuit says it's like a cobra. If the cobra's in the cell and you send the guy into the cell without telling him about it, and you're aware that the cobra's there, that's deliberate indifference. Here, MB or Bantu is the cobra. They look in the room. He has to be there. So it's not a huge room. You know, if you check it, you can tell if the guy's there or not. Clearly the guy was there. They come tell him he's not there. And I don't know why they told him that. We don't have to be concerned with that right now. It could be they wanted to see a fight. Maybe they were tired of the protocol, tired of my client complaining about his safety, complaining about this guy all the time. Maybe they wanted to see if a fight would really occur. Maybe it's like, I don't know if you're hockey fans, but usually in the NHL, players get chippy. There's a fight between two guys and then it ends everything. You know, it kind of clears the air and it takes care of things. Maybe they wanted to see that. Maybe they just wanted to be done with the protocol. I don't know. But the point is, an argument can be made, an inference can be made. They checked the room. He was there. They knew he was there. Yet they told our guy he's not there. So that's why our guy walks down the hall. And so it's akin, Your Honor, I think, to they put him down there. They gave him the opportunity to go down there to the room where the cobra was, just like in the case where they put the guy in the cell with the gentleman that assaulted him in Nelson v. Shuffman. So I think the cases are more alike than different, Your Honor. And I think that's the big thing. And in the analysis, the question is there a significant substantial risk? Did these guys know about it? They're claiming, oh, I don't know. That's well, they might be claiming that because they're in a lawsuit, but let's be real. The Phoenix system, there was a note put out there by Ms. Herrick, who's the therapist that was at the July meeting and saw how violent and angry that Bantu was towards Mr. Stone. These guys are supposed to check that every day. They claim they didn't, but you know what? They also say, well, we got to have situational awareness. We got to know what's going on in the facility.
But isn't that why the judge denied the motion for summary judgment? It seems that there are a lot of facts that
I believe
are plainly disputed.
Well, I think it's because of this, Your Honor. A case is a story. And in this case, a lot of what Mr. Dietrich says, it's good stuff. It looks good on its face. But you know what? It's argument. It's closing argument material. It's a way of looking at what happened. Same with us on our side. And because you have two stories that are valid, no jury, I think, can say that one, absolutely, that it's not like the Scott Harris case where they said the video is dispositive, meaning despite what the plaintiff there said, where the guy goes, you know, it's like he was on a Sunday drive, signaling turn, slowing down, signaling his lane changes, when it was really, and they put the video up on their website, Scalia says, it's a Hollywood chase. These are things that we usually only see in the movies, and it was real life. And they said at that point, they're not going to believe the fiction that the other guy threw up. But that's not what we have here. What we have here is a genuine dispute of important material facts. And I think that's why Judge Kyle found as he did. And the fact that he didn't mention the video specifically, I think, is just evidence of that. He found it's not a Scott Harris video. It's not conclusive. I don't have to deal with it. It's like everything else. It's just part of the whole thing. And there's a dispute of the facts. And in Judge Kyle's order, he mentions their knowledge. They say they don't know. Stone says, I told them they knew, et cetera. There's the protocol. And remember, at this point for where you're at, you're not to weigh the evidence. You have to take what Judge Kyle says about that fact dispute and actually accept it. I think this isn't, you know, and therefore he was right to say we get a trial. There's no qualified immunity as a matter of law. We establish the constitutional violation if you believe our side of the story. We establish the deliberate indifference, meaning their knowledge and their failure to act or to continue with the protocol and protect him. We establish that, and I think that's the proximate cause of the injury. The proximate cause isn't just that he worked. It's not like the guy who, he voluntarily assumed the risk when he played volleyball. I think they cite it. In one of the cases, they have a string cite and they talk about where people assume the risk. One of them was a guy who played volleyball. I think a better example is you have a job in the wood shop and you're not very good at the table saw, but you know, you go work and do it anyways, and you cut your hand off, or you cut a finger off. Well, that's on you.
Do you agree with, Mr. Dietrich, that the Fifth Amendment only applies to federal employees? It does, that shouldn't have been pled in your complaint?
I think we can plead the Fifth Amendment, but it's, if you read some of the cases, they say, well, remember the Fifth Amendment applies to the states, I believe, through the 14th Amendment. So I guess I would disagree with that. I don't think that these are state actors.
But you didn't challenge that in your brief.
If I did, I'm sorry I overlooked that. But I think it's
Dusenberry versus United States Supreme Court case. Position that the Fifth Amendment's due process clause only applies to the federal government.
Well, if that case says that, but the problem is you have cases that say that the Fifth Amendment due process clauses apply via the 14th Amendment to the states. That's a common thing. At least that's often the way it is in excessive force cases and whatnot. But number two, I think in one of the cases, I don't have it off the tip of my head, it's in the stuff that we have. But the way they analyze these, they say, well, Eighth Amendment is usually where these things come up because you got prisoners. But then they say, well, what about pretrial detainees? Or in this case, like a person who's civilly committed, they say, well, really where you analyze it under the due process clause, but they're the same under the 14th Amendment. So they say they're the same. So I think in a way, Judge, my position would be that the Fifth Amendment analysis you're suggesting doesn't matter because 14th Amendment and the idea of state actor has to protect someone in this case, it goes in that way through the 14th and 8th. So.
And I think that's what appellants say, that it goes in through the 8th and the 14th, as you just
right.
said.
Yeah. And I believe that's our position. I think in our complaint, we actually said that. So I believe so. So I only have a few seconds left. At the end of the day, Your Honors, there's factual disputes here. There's a dispute, which means we get our day in court. We get to have a trial. They get to argue their actions were reasonable. They still have defenses. Let's not forget that. This doesn't decide the case, but what it should do is it gets us our trial and gets Mr. Stone his day in court. I ask that you affirm the case and that you send it back for trial. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Dietrich, any rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, thank you. First of all, Mr. Swanson pointed to cases cited in the state's brief about, a person voluntarily assuming the risk when they're playing volleyball or something like that. Well, I would point the court to a case that was cited, Benner versus Magadori, where the Seventh Circuit said that the plaintiff had failed to make out a failure to protect claim where he had been threatened by a rival gang. He was in a special housing unit, I believe, where he was supposed to be escorted by guards at all times. He wasn't being escorted by guards. He, I believe, asked guards to escort him, and they didn't escort him. And then one of these rival gang members threatened to destroy his legal papers if he didn't come get them. And so he walked up to this rival gang member's cell and then had scalding hot water thrown in his face. And the court said, he voluntarily put himself in that position, and he cannot make out a failure to protect claim in that scenario. That case is far more similar to this case than Nelson, where again, the individual was involuntarily placed in the room with this individual and then was assaulted almost immediately, the same day that they were placed in that room. Also, this claim that Mr. Stone only walked down towards MB's room because Preston and or Wallace told him that MB wasn't in the room. Well, respondents contradicted that and appeared to take that back in his deposition. If you look at the deposition, he was asked about this affidavit that he submitted in MB's criminal case, where he specifically said that he saw MB on the unit when he got there, and that MB was then returned to his room. And when he was asked about that, he said that as he was walking down the hall, because of that, he assumed that MB was in the room. So that claim, doesn't make any sense to me. The other thing that I wanted to mention that Mr. Swanson pointed to was notes in the Phoenix system about MB making threats to a respondent. Again, there are no notes after the end of July of 2016, nothing. So again, that 6-week period between these threats that the district court said that the appellants were aware of and the assault is sufficient time for them to conclude that there's no substantial risk of harm. And like I said, there's no case law that would have put them on notice that they were required to respond in this drastic way based on threats that had occurred 6 weeks ago. Now, appellant claims, or respondent claims that after that, that he was continued to be, that MB continued to threaten him. I'm not disputing that, but there's no evidence that any of the defendants were aware of those continued threats. And that's what matters. So, Your Honor.
So, counsel, if the record shows that Mr. Stone testified that he believed that one or both Preston and Wallace were present and able to hear those ongoing threats by MB, then do we have a disputed fact issue?
No, Your Honor, he didn't specify. Well, first of all, it's speculation as to whether or not he heard anything.
I'm not asking you to, I'm not asking you about speculation. I'm asking you to just assume the truth of what Mr. Stone testified to.
Right. I'm just saying that he can't testify as to whether or not they heard anything. But he also testified that he didn't know, you know, when that was. He was adamant that he didn't know, you know, when they worked or when they might have been following him and heard those threats. So that cannot create a fact issue that they were aware of threats after that. And especially as to Wallace, Mr. Stone admitted that he never talked with Wallace about any sort of threats that MB ever made. And I believe that the district court didn't find that Wallace was necessarily aware of any of MB's threats, only that he was in the vicinity when threats were made at some point, I believe in late July 2016, but not after that. So Your Honors, I believe my time's up. I would just ask that the court reverse the district court and grant appellants qualified immunity.
Thank you, counsel. The case was well briefed and well argued, and we will have our decision out within 90 days.